Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. The first time I encountered the Catholic agency Aid to the Church in Need was when I got a phone call from their office in about 1982 to ask me, since I had already made some clandestine runs into Russia on behalf of the underground church, if I would smuggle for them some theological books for the underground Catholic Church in Prague to train priests who were training incognito in seminaries outside the ken of the authorities. Alexander Tomsky was in charge at the time. He was a Czech emigre, a man of serious intellectual astuteness, a wonderfully colourful character. He offered me two ways to make the clandestine journey. He'd somehow acquired a car which had been converted for drug smuggling, which he thought would make an excellent means of transporting large numbers of books hidden in its various compartments, or else I could go by plane and carry a couple of suitcases. I did fancy driving through Europe in a drug smuggler's car containing the contraband of Christian theology books destined for the underground seminary in Prague, but I also thought that if I got caught, it would be impossible to find any way of mitigating the anger and political aggression that would inevitably follow, so I opted for a plane flight and two suitcases. Aid to the Church in Need has always trod the delicate balance between informing the Western Church of the cost that so many brave Christians were paying to keep their faith with Christ, whilst at the same time doing whatever could be done, either politically or practically, to offer solidarity and help from the rest of the Church. Christians continue to be persecuted throughout the world, and there's no better time than Passion Tide to allow ourselves the opportunity to reflect on the suffering Church. And we welcome John Pontifex from today's Aid to the Church in Need to help us do it. And he joins me now. John, thank you very much for joining me for this conversation. I think that the first thing we need to do is to introduce Aid to the Church in Need to our listeners and then also introduce you. So could you give us a potted history of how Aid to the Church in Need started its relationship with Catholicism and what it's doing today? And then we'll talk a little bit about you and move from that to Christians who are being persecuted for the faith, which is the focus of what you and the organization do. So how did the organization start?
Well, the organization Aid to the Church in Need was founded in 1947 in response to the extremely difficult situation in Europe after the Second World War, where you had huge numbers of German refugees in Belgium and elsewhere. And the founder of Aid to the Church in Need decided at that point that this was an important time to reach out to these displaced refugee communities from all over Germany in not only an act of physical support, but also an act of reconciliation after the Second World War. So he was asking people not only to reach across different language barriers, but also across divisions of history and of conflict. And he then set up the organization, which then quickly became Iron Curtain Relief. And so Aid to the Church in Need was at work providing support for persecuted Christians behind the Iron Curtain, not least in Poland and Hungary and all those very important parts of the world to the east of the Berlin Wall. And by degrees, the charity spread and is now at work in more than 130 countries around the world.
I first came across it when I joined, or I was associated with Keston College. Keston College, of course, started by Michael Bordeaux, was doing something very similar. And it decided that its main focus was communication, to let people in the West know quite how bad things were behind the Iron Curtain. And it tried to work through other agencies to deal with practical need. How did Aid to the Church in Need divide this dual responsibility of telling people what was going on and offering them help at the same time? Did it do both?
Yes, we have as our strapline prayer, information and action. So what this means in practical terms is that we know that the various forms of support are by nature interlocking. People can't be expected to offer help unless they know about the situation. And in this context, you can't know about the situation of suffering Christians without being committed to pray for them. And so you can see a direct interplay between these various aspects. So in material terms, we provide support in the form of 5,000 projects almost every year, spread across 140 countries, providing support in the form of child's Bibles, mass stipends for priests ministering in places of persecution and extreme poverty, catechesis support for lay catechists, for seminarians, for sisters, and of course, building and repairing churches and emergency help in those countries where we're active. And of course, we're committed to informing people, not least through our own reports, specifically our report on religious freedom internationally, religious freedom in the world, looking at all the countries around the world, and also Persecuted and Forgotten Report, which we in the UK edit, which looks specifically at those countries where there are particularly difficult situations for Christians and where persecution is often at its worst. So we produce these reports on a rolling basis, as well as news reports and other updates that inform people about topics that are sometimes very much on the fringe of people's consciousness. And we seek to draw those to the center of people's consciousness so that they feel that they understand and feel empowered to help, because the whole premise of Aid to the Church Needs work is that not only is it possible to help, but a lot can be achieved through that help.
I was recruited and sent as a discreet underground courier carrying suitcases of theology books to help provide seminary training for the underground priests in Czechoslovakia in about 1984. I was very impressed, both of the people I met who ran the organization then and also the links in Prague. It was a wonderful organization. But of course, in those days, the main source of persecution for Christians that everyone was at least nominally aware of was the Soviet Union. That's become much more complex. Before I ask you how persecution is being expressed nowadays and where its main centers are and what the main ideological drivers are, how did you get involved with ACN? What's your background?
Well, I was a newspaper journalist working with the Kent Messenger down in Maidstone in Kent. And I'd been there for about 5 years as a reporter. And I went to Mass one Sunday and heard an appeal from one of the so-called area secretaries of Aid to the Church in Need, who outlined the work of the charity and its importance. And I thought, this sounds an interesting organization. And I submitted my CV at that point. Hey presto, got the job of head of press and information. I've done that work for over 20 years now, working at in different parts of the world where there's persecution. I've been traveling to many parts of the world where there is persecution and oppression, and seen for myself not only the struggles that Christians face, but also what Aid to the Church in Need is doing to help.
So can you draw us a map today of what persecution looks like with the coming down of the wall in 1989 and the extraordinary renaissance of the Russian Orthodox Church, which is still one of the things that's happened in my lifetime that amazes me, that the Christian allegiance went from 0.0 something or other to a situation where I think nominally over 50% of Russians identify as Russian Orthodox, whatever the cash value of that is, but it was quite extraordinary. So now we have secular persecution still behind in China, and Islamic persecution. Have I missed anything out?
We've also got other forms of state oppression, state-led oppression in different countries where the state is specifically opposed to Christian and other faith groups who it deems to be a distinct problem and potentially undermining of the authority and of its structure. And Christianity is often perceived as being a Western infiltration and an invidious force at work in society. So we see that problem borne out in a number of regimes that are either atheistic or indeed have a religio-nationalist focus that perceives in Christianity an implicit, if not direct, threat. But you're absolutely right. Some of the most horrific forms of persecution are to be found in countries where extremist Islam or forces that call themselves Islamic but aren't necessarily Islamic do terrific harm. And many of the countries where I have traveled, I've met individuals, communities, families, churches who've suffered egregiously as a result of that persecution at the hands of extremists.
What are some of the difficulties in communicating this? Because, I mean, I remember before 1989, one of the reasons I went behind the Iron Curtain was because the establishment and the person in the street and the media organizations and above all left-wing newspapers flatly refused to believe that Christians were having a hard time in the Soviet Union. In fact, they were being vigorously persecuted, depending on which particular president was in power at the time. Some were slightly less ruthless and some were rather more ruthless. But it was extremely difficult to persuade people that this level of discrimination, persecution and execution sometimes were taking place. My sense is now that it's still quite difficult for politically correct reasons to talk about what's happening in the Islamic world. I think no one has trouble with China and holding the Chinese nominally account for the way in which they treat people. The Uyghurs seem to get more publicity than the underground Christians do. What difficulties do you find in trying to persuade people, or at least inform people, that Christianity is the world's most persecuted religion?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I think the starting point in this discussion is to acknowledge that there is still a cultural, institutional resistance to the notion that, yes, Christianity is persecuted. And yes, as you rightly say, it is, by one measure at least, the most persecuted faith in the world. And I think the reasons are largely to do with two forces. The first is that culturally, and in our media particularly, there is a tendency to link Christianity with the establishment and with the West and with power and with influence. So it's very difficult against that backdrop to visualize a situation where the majority of Christians now are to be found in the global South, an impoverished global South. And if you look at where Christians are most numerous, they are often those countries where actually Christianity is a minority in terms of its influence and in terms of where the power base lies. The other factor that's worth drawing out here is that the nature of Christian persecution, oppression, harassment is by its nature quite nuanced. And often it's not the case that churches are being routinely burnt down every day, or people are being flogged to death or being sent off en masse into some kind of gulag scenario. But in an alarming number of countries, there is what you might call second-tier persecution, whereby there is the outburst or outbreak of persecution, whereby a church can get attacked, community can get displaced, but it happens sporadically. And so day by day, it's not something that's happening, but it does happen perhaps every few months or every few years. And the psychological pressure that leaves in between times is almost as difficult to bear as the outbreak of persecution itself. So in real terms, we're saying, along with the Pew Research Center, that Christianity suffers the worst persecution in terms of the number of countries where this persecution is taking place, which in Christianity's case is far more countries than is the case with other faith groups. And indeed, the most recent report from the Pew Research Center indicates that Christians are persecuted very, very widely. We see a situation in which Christianity is suffering harassment and worse in 155 countries around the world. And we've seen that number of countries where Christians are harassed increase over the last decade, according to the Pew Research Center, from, say, 100 to 150. So that harassment is there. But in many of these countries, Christians are not the community that suffers the worst persecution. So, for example, as you rightly point out, China. And we can say in China, yes, there are some terrible incidents, and we can relate a number of them, churches that are closed, communities that suffer, but it's not necessarily the case that Christians suffer as badly or as widely as do the Uyghurs, but that there are many more countries where Christians are the second worst persecuted group than is the case with many other faith groups. So there are, of course, exceptions to that, Nigeria being a key example where we reckon that up to 5,000 Christians were killed last year alone, and where there was a terrible attack on a church in Owo, down in the southwest of Nigeria, in which 40 people were killed and more than 70 were injured. And so in that particular instance, yes, Christians are the most persecuted group in terms of numbers and in terms of severity. All this does is to demonstrate the complexity of the situation and the need for people to really understand those nuances, and also to recognize that, yes, there are times where Christians really suffer terrible persecution.
I had the extraordinary experience of meeting one of the Catholic bishops in southern Nigeria. It was from his diocese that I think 300 or 400 young Catholic girls were kidnapped by Boko Haram, and he had a vision of Christ one night at the Blessed Sacrament, who brought to him a sword in this vision that turned into a rosary. His name was Bishop Oliver, and it's still on YouTube there. But I remember thinking, this is such a powerful thing to have happened, but both in terms of having 300 girls kidnapped, but also for the bishop to have a vision of our Lord. I was surprised it didn't make its way more into the public space but it didn't seem to. And then there's this discrete ones you talk about. I'm talking to you from France, where we're recording this, where I have a small little cottage, and I'm still very struck by the fact that it seems to be the case that about 1,000 Catholic churches a year are being burnt down in France every year. No one knows exactly why, though people make guesses, but it's this element of psychological pressure and the coming and going of it, the fact that it appears to be sporadic, I think was the word you used, that makes it very difficult to deal with it. Is this sporadic persecution something that you find yourself trying to communicate or understand or evaluate?
Well, it is. And I think it's key to this, because people can be very shrill about the topic of religious freedom or persecution. And that can be actually really unhelpful. And this is a message that comes to us from our project partners. So I've just come back from Pakistan, a country where, sadly, the situation for religious minorities has been difficult for a number of years, and where, in real terms, you can argue and you can show that it's getting worse. But specifically there, what you see happening is there are incidents of really egregious persecution. So, for example, we met while we were there clandestinely a pair of nurses, two nurses working in a government hospital. And one day they're in this psychiatric ward, and one of the patients in the psychiatric ward goes and picks at a sticker on a medicine cabinet, and then peels a bit of this sticker off and hands it to one of the nurses. And of course, it's got on the sticker a slogan from the Quran. And the next thing that happens is the two nurses, both Christian, of course, both Catholic, are accused of blasphemy under 295B of the Pakistan Penal Code, where blasphemy of that nature can land somebody in jail theoretically for a lifetime. In that country, the extremists don't wait for the law to take effect. The mob descends, as indeed happened in this case, where suddenly the hospital is invaded by a mob who are baying for the two nurses' blood. And indeed, one of the nurses was stabbed, although fortunately only in the hand, and she was able to escape. But since when, the opportunities for justice have been few and far between, and they've been lucky to obtain bail. But 2 years after this incident, almost exactly 2 years after this incident, they are living in hiding. And essentially, the threat of the extremist groups and the power that they hold over the local community is such that for the two nurses to demonstrate in court successfully that they were innocent of this crime is very, very difficult. And so they're living in hiding. They go around from place to place to avoid detection. And they urgently need our support and our prayers and our financial support to fight their case and to thereby eventually one day receive an acquittal, in which case they'll be able, hopefully, to begin to return to some semblance of normality. But the threat of incidents like this that can happen at any time and have happened many, many times over the years means that Christians in that country live with this fear always in the background that they could easily be accused of blasphemy under a false pretense, under a false accusation, and they cannot expect the law to protect them. Sometimes it's possible for the law to eventually prevail in their favour, as happened in the case that we were following. And Aid to the Church Need is working very closely with Catholic groups, lawyers, and other communities to enable those Christians who are accused of blasphemy to find justice and to rebuild their lives. But day to day, Christians, of course, in Pakistan can exist. They can get jobs, they can go to school, they can move about. But incidents such as what happened to those two nurses in Faisalabad, Punjab, demonstrate that what can suddenly befall perfectly innocent people just going about their day-to-day business.
Perhaps we can talk about that, because I think this is one of the most difficult areas in dealing with Christian persecution. And we're inevitably hedged around by threats of being Islamophobic. And so it's very difficult to have a conversation like this because of the fear of being targeted as such. I've always been very unhappy about the way in which the journalists in the West have tried to make a distinction. I've indeed made the distinction between Islam and Islamism. Obviously, Islam is a hybrid between both religion and politics, but making a distinction between its spirituality and its political ambitions is something that Islam itself doesn't recognize. So you talk very helpfully about the fact that Christians can live in Islamic jurisdictions like Pakistan, and you've described the danger to the nurses as coming from a mob rather than from religion, which I'm sure is quite right. How does Aid to the Church in Need get round or through, or how do you find a sure-footed way in describing the difficulties that Christianity has with Islam or with Muslims? We know perfectly well that we probably all have congenial Muslim neighbours and friends with whom we talk, and we know that we're not attempting to pillory them. But nonetheless, we also know that there can be expressions of Islamic faith which become immensely violent and, in some contexts, unreasonable. Do you have any advice in terms of helping Christians in the West walk their way through this minefield of how we describe our relationship with a religion that has the capacity and the track record of persecuting Christianity of a very distinctive kind historically?
It is, Gavin, a point, and we know that unless we address it, we're not going to move forward, because to have honest and open dialogue is essential in order to move forward, recognizing that the call for justice, for peace, is absolutely at the foundation of any society in which different groups come together. And I think what I would say about this is the need to call out acts that are absolutely clearly aggressive by their very nature. So, for example, we had a wonderful bishop called Bishop Jude Arigundade from Ondo in southern Nigeria. He would know your friend Bishop Oliver Dashidome from Maiduguri, who I've met many times before.
Oh, he's wonderful. A wonderful, I'm so bishop glad. And a very prophetic. Isn't he amazing? Yes.
He is.
Yes.
He's just a real character and a very strong and insightful and spiritually very clear-sighted man. And Bishop Jude, he is an academic. He studied in Harvard. He became bishop there in Ondo. And on June the 5th of last year, his world changed. It turned upside down when his church of St. Francis Xavier in Owo fell victim to a terrible act carried out by jihadists. At least they claimed took responsibility for it. 41 dead, more than 70 injured. And we invited Bishop Jude to come to this country, and he spoke on BBC Radio 4, the Today programme. He was asked there about the experience. And then he explained that the numbers who died, the numbers who were wounded, and he said that jihadists had been responsible for this. And he was then asked, well, Bishop, aren't you by saying this actually feeding Islamophobia? Mm-hmm. The only answer that any reasonable person can give is that in the interests of justice and peace and accuracy, it's important to tell the story and to lay out those facts calmly and clearly, and at the same time appeal for justice. It's not for us to cast a judgment or make statements, any form of condemnation of people's religious beliefs. But it is for us to say no to harm your fellow human being in a situation where they're simply offering an act of prayer, where they're coming together in this way. And that is just plainly wrong. And we feel very strongly at Aid to the Church Need, the need to both articulate the facts of the case so far as we can ascertain them, and to speak to those facts as best as they can be established, and to appeal for justice and peace against that backdrop. And we feel there's a dereliction of duty where we don't do that.
I guess very helpful. I'm sure a lot of people will find at least the implicit permission to answer a charge of Islamophobia with, well, I'm simply narrating what happened, and I'm not joining any dots between action and ideology, which is, of course, then allows people to accuse you of being prejudiced, as being very helpful indeed. Thank you very much. I mean, I think it's probably the best one can do, isn't it? And again, it's extremely important to have an organisation like ACN telling the truth and documenting what actually happened, leaving it perhaps to others to do the theology and the analysis, but simply saying, as a historical record, this is what's taken place against the Christian community.
Yes, I'm sure that's absolutely correct. It's important as well for us, particularly at Aid to the Church Need, to remember that when we speak as an organisation, we have to be mindful that the people who are most directly affected by what we say are the people having to live in these situations. We're there to help them. So if we take our eye off the ball and speak in a way that actually damages their situation, puts them at greater threat, then we're failing in our duty. And you know, we always say, don't we, in our culture, that careless talk costs lives. And I think that is true, particularly in the context of situation of persecution. And again, if I may, going back to Pakistan, we work very closely with an organization which is committed to advocating for justice and peace within Pakistan. And they told us directly that they are trailed by the authorities who keep a close watch on them. And you when speaking with them and spending time with them, it really came home to me just how we've got to balance this need to be both honest, clear, and morally sound, and yet at the same time pastorally sensitive, mindful that people's lives are at stake here, and that we have to balance these two competing challenges without losing our sense of what we can argue is true and just in the process.
Yes, pastorally and politically sensitive. That's very helpful. So we're coming, of course, to Holy Week as you and I talk, and one of the things that all Christians are aware of, and one of the reasons for our having this conversation, is the promise that Christians will have trouble in the world and will indeed be persecuted. There is something about Jesus which draws out of the metaphysical melting pot opposition and anger. You've given an explanation of the persecution of Christians in political terms, saying, well, there is a resentment against Christianity with its association of being allied with power and influence and all the responsibility of misusing power and influence. Do you have a metaphysical, a spiritual understanding to offer of why Christians seem to be persecuted in so many different contexts by so many different ideologies, religious and political?
I think that as Christians, we are a community committed to both the dignity of the individual, where that dignity is most infringed and won't most violated. And Christianity, by its very nature, stands with the oppressed, with the downtrodden. And it is not, by its nature, when it's true to itself, committed to the obtaining of power and influence. But because it speaks for truth, and because it speaks for justice, and because it's a worldwide community, for those reasons, it can land itself in situations where it is prey to attack. And I've been immensely struck in my 20 years with Aid to the Church Need by church leaders, sisters, lay faithful priests who have been champions for their community, and where they have spoken up for that community precisely by articulating the truths of our faith. And I mean, I spent happily spent some time with a great friend of ours at Aid to the Church, and Cardinal Joseph Coutts, he was in charge at different times of three dioceses in Pakistan, in some very, very difficult situations there. And he has been such a champion for the downtrodden, for the poor, and been such a wise and compassionate pastor. And, you know, you can see how it's been really difficult for him and his community, but he has somehow kept going and kept the faith. And that I find deeply, deeply inspiring. And I can think of other people like Cardinal Zubair Wacko in Sudan, who somehow survived through the years of Omar al-Bashir, when he was meeting out some pretty horrific treatment to Christians at various times. But this man, again, stuck up for his people. We worked very carefully and very strongly with him in support of the displaced communities in Khartoum and out into the desert. And I went and visited some of those communities where we built up schools and displacement centers. And he was a very clear champion for the poor and for the truth of our faith. And he struggled. It wasn't easy for him. But he said he found it better to stick to that and to remain committed to his calling than to somehow retreat and find himself in an easier way of life. I've always found that a deeply inspiring path. And I think hopefully through the work at Aid to the Church Need, we're able to communicate that and to encourage others to follow that same path.
If people want to support you, both obviously praying, but also in terms of giving financially and being informed by you, do you have a newsletter or a form of subscription that you can direct people towards?
Well, the best thing to do is to go to our website, and it is www.acnuk.org. And there you will find opportunities both to sign up to our e-newsletter, to our regular newsletter as well, that comes in the post every month or 6 weeks or so. And you'll find on that website all sorts of opportunities to support the work of Aid to the Church Need, not least through our petition that we've got going at the moment, which is calling for the perpetrators of that attack at that church in Owo, in which 40 people were killed, 70 plus injured, to bring to justice those responsible. So there's all sorts of ways you can get involved through that prayer, through that advocacy, through that financial support, supporting to the victims, the survivors of the earthquake in Syria and elsewhere that we had back in February. So there's options there to support in so many different ways, from mass stipends as well. And so do go on that website, www.acnuk.org, and you can find out all about ACN and how to help us and help those who suffer for their faith.
John, thank you. There are all kinds of para-church organizations. They come and go, they flourish and diminish. But I think we're working for persecuted Christians, we're working for an organization that will never run out of work to do.
No, it seems that way,
yes. Thank you for all you're doing for them. And thank you for talking to us. And for all those who are listening while this is going out, a happy and joyful Easter. John, thank you.
Thank you very much, Gavin. Great to be with you.